I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, my guest is poet Lee Young Lee. He is perhaps one of the most famous, well-known poets in the English language. And of course, when we say the term famous poet, it's like an oxymoron because there is no famous poet. The famous people are Beyonce and these big celebrities. I was talking to a friend recently. I was back in Fresno. I was talking to a childhood friend and I said, yeah, I'm going to have Lee Young Lee on the show. And my friend goes, who's that? But my friend doesn't read poetry. Yet later on that night, I was hanging out with a bunch of poets because we were at this event for Andrés Montoya symposium, a big gathering around his poetry. And I mentioned to them, to my poet friends, I'm going to have Lee Young Lee on the show. And they were all, wow, that's great. I can't wait to hear it. Lee Young Lee is pretty much as famous as you're going to ever get as a poet. He is author of multiple books, winner of multiple poetry prizes, and he is also a very humble, sweet man, and I'm honored to have him on the show. So stick around, and we're going to talk about his latest book, The Undressing. Lee Young Lee is perhaps one of the most well-known living poets writing in the English language, and he is certainly one of my favorite poets. He is author of Spoken For, Behind My Eyes, Book of My Nights, and one of my favorite books of poems. I've read it over and over again, The City in Which I Love You. But his new book, The Undressing, just came out, and it's also an amazing book. Lee Young Lee, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you, Daniel.
Well, thank you for joining us. I've loved your poetry for many years now, ever since I've been a writer. But I remember when Behind My Eyes came out, my first reaction was, wow, these poems seem to approach the mystical. They brought your work to a whole nother level. Like, you couldn't have written it when you were a brilliant young poet in 1986 when Rose, your first book, came out. And I feel the same way about The Undressing, that this is a book you couldn't have written 20, 30 years ago. Would you agree with that?
I would. I wouldn't have known enough 20, 30 years ago how to even get to those poems in this last book, you know. And I feel like I've been working my way toward being able to speak, being able to write those poems, you know.
Right. Yeah, it seems like it was an inevitable development where you headed in the last two books. In The City in Which I Love You, which came out 28 years ago, so I imagine the poems are written maybe 30 years ago. And when you were a young man, you write lines like, your otherness is as perfect as my death. And then at one point, the speaker of the poem writes, bearing the mark of one who's experienced neither heaven nor hell. You've been grappling, I guess, with these issues for a long time.
Yeah, this idea of heaven and hell has been really interesting to me all my life. I do know that heaven and hell, that line that separates heaven and hell, you know, like Solzhenitsyn said, it runs right through every individual, you know.
Right.
And I was just wondering what the word had to do. Actually, Daniel, I've been wondering about this all my life, but I feel as if I didn't even have the psychic capacity or nimbleness to be able to even think about this stuff, you know, like the nature of the word. I knew that the nature of the word is just such a profound idea that I stood in front of the idea for years without even knowing how to think about it. But reading Heraclitus helped me when he said that the word is the dynamism of opposites, and out of that dynamism of opposites, of heaven and hell, good and evil, night and day, every deep binary opposite that we engage in when we live, when we speak, when we walk, you know, it's all Tai Chi. And, you know, the Chinese definition of Tai Chi is the practice of extreme opposites.
Mm-hmm.
And then it wasn't until after years of practice of Tai Chi and thinking about the nature of the word that I realized that's what the word is. It's the practice of Tai Chi, you know, the word sound and silence and meaning and nonsense. And I thought, wow, there's a conversion here, a confluence of ideas, this ancient Greek idea of the logos of the word, and then this ancient Chinese idea of the Tai Chi, yin and yang, and emptiness and fullness, form and void. You know, the Buddhists named those opposites in a very meticulous way, you know, and I thought, wow, all the great mystical and religious traditions have been talking about this forever. You know, in the Judeo-Christian traditions, you know, in the beginning was the Word. So in the beginning was this dynamism of opposites. But an interesting thing happened in the West. You know, we started to think of the Logos as a primarily masculine thing. Mm-hmm. You know, and Heraclitus is very clear. He says it's the dynamism of opposites that is the Logos. So the Logos is actually a negotiation of feminine and male and feminine and dark and light and yielding and moving forward and emptiness and fullness. And all of this stuff is just going on. And I didn't even know how to think about it, you know, but I knew even as a young man that this was the kind of big mysterious room that was kind of, I was enthralled with this idea, but I didn't even know how to get there. I didn't even know how to approach it, you know?
Yeah. And your father was a minister. And so I imagine that a lot of the reading and the first images and narratives and uses of language came from the Bible. And then, of course, you referenced in the beginning was the Word. And then, of course, it goes, then the Word was with God and the Word was God. So I'm wondering how much that biblical reading the Bible and the stories of the Bible and the language of the Bible influenced your entry into poetry.
Oh, it was huge, you know. Stories of the Bible, the ideas in the Bible, the whole progress of the heroes in the stories. You know, it seemed to me that one could read it as a depiction of an evolution of the soul, where in the beginning of the Bible, the voice of God, the voice of the Word is outside the listener. You know, the prophet hears the voice from outside, you know. Hmm. And as the stories proceed, it seems to me that that voice gets more and more introjected. It comes more and more from the inside. So that by the time you have somebody like Jesus, he's walking around, he's hearing voices, but I think they're more interiorized with him. You know, he becomes the ark. He becomes the object in which all the code for the next world is embedded in him. It's encoded in him, you know. I mean, in the beginning, we have Noah's Ark, where all the everything you need to begin a civilization again gets put inside the ark, and the world gets destroyed, and then but by the time of the New Testament, what we have is everything you need to begin a civilization is found in a person, you know. And mm-hmm. It seems to me like that adventure of finding those beginnings of a civilization inside our own psyches, inside our own hearts and minds and souls, that seems like the big adventure to me. I think the whole biblical, the Judeo-Christian tradition is a kind of depiction of that, you know. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, in the East, there's the same tradition, but it's just under different terms, you know. The whole journey to the West, the great Chinese classic, is basically about that, you know, mm-hmm. about the search for inner values, you know. And it turns out that those inner values are the very values that the cosmos itself is founded on.
And as you're talking about it, I can't help but think of how there's some sort of space between languages that doesn't yet have language, or maybe even has a deeper language. So I'm thinking, you know, you grew up or you were born in Indonesia to Chinese parents, you spoke Chinese, and then your father became a minister here and was using the Bible. And I think I even, there's a reference to your father teaching the King James Version Bible to some prison guards. And I'm thinking that, you know, you have the King James translations, then you have the other translations, and then you get lines like, you know, do not arouse or awake in love before it so desires. And then you get another translation that might say, do not awake my love before he wants. And this existence between languages just kind of, I don't know, it just seems like there's so much there that's beyond the words. And your talk of persimmons and precision, and I'm wondering how living between multiple translations of the Bible, living between multiple translations between Chinese and English, might have given you an awareness of language that caused you to begin to see something beyond just the words.
I think so. I think that experience of many languages pointing to a single object and having and witnessing many ways to talk about an object, you know, and many names for that object. And even if the object is abstract and it's an idea or, you know, but many ways to talk about that object, it kind of I think one grows up realizing that we can approach that object, we can almost name it, you know, but we can't get hung up on the names, you know, that the desired object, the real beloved, is beyond the names for the beloved, you know. And I think even this lover and beloved, the meeting of the lover and beloved, is actually, I think, the prime symbol of the word. You know, but I've been thinking, Daniel, that there's two instances where we enact the word on a, like a visceral and mental and emotional and soulful way. That is in erotic love and in hand-to-hand combat. So it's this meeting of the other, you know, and switching places, changing places. Sometimes you're the beloved, sometimes you're the lover, and sometimes the other one's the lover and the beloved. It's very fluid, changing back and forth.
This brings us to the poem, the opening poem to your new book, The Undressing. It's an erotic poem. It's a man and a woman making love, but as the man is undressing the woman on a literal level, she's talking about war and she's talking about violence. And I'm wondering, and this is kind of encompasses a question I have about your process. When you begin to write a poem, specifically this poem and in general, do you know where you're going and what it's going to be about? Or are these issues just so much fundamentally part of you that they come out through the language and the images?
Yeah, I think it's much closer to the second state of affairs you described. You know, I know that that relationship between the lover and beloved was an obsession for me. You know, and I wanted to understand it. I wanted to know, to understand what was at the bottom of that relationship. You know, and what is actually going on when we meet in an erotic encounter where we feel safe to speak most deeply, you know, with our bodies, with our words. And I was just writing to explore that, but then all these issues of violence and other things kept coming up. And I kept realizing, Daniel, that I was really hopelessly undeveloped as a person in regards to the erotic, you know, thinking about it and understanding it. And my encounter with the world is basically a sensual encounter.
Right.
I'm trying to access the world through sensuality. And yet the world, I think the woman in that poem, The Undressing, is a voice for, I don't know, maybe reality altogether or something, you know? And like reality is trying to speak to me at some other level, maybe at a wisdom level or at a soulful level or at a mental level, intellectual level. I'm just trying to understand reality purely, just sensually, you know?
Right.
Maybe even in a base way, you know? And I realize what a buffoon I am.
Did you ever feel like you had to pull back, like maybe you were being a little bit too explicit?
I did. And I cut out a lot, you know, and I didn't know, I couldn't tell what was kinky, what was not.
Right.
You know, what was specific to me. I was even wondering, like, is this too specifically heterosexual? Do homosexuals experience that of this? I wouldn't even know.
Right.
I understood that the erotic arena was a kind of very fecund, a very fertile place to begin, because there's so much that's allowed. Once we're in a consensual encounter, there's a lot allowed.
Right.
And I wanted to see that allowance, because I felt as if there's a lot disallowed in speech, you know, and I wanted to see what could be let in, you know. I gave up on the poem. It's not even finished, Daniel. I'm frustrated. I don't know how to finish it. You know, I don't know how to finish it. I don't know how much further. And I do know I'm trying to understand the encounter between logos and eros. So this confluence of opposites, again, you're male and female, you know. And I was trying to understand, like, is there a difference, you know, between the male and the female and the lover and the beloved? You know, the Greeks insisted that in any romantic encounter, there's no such thing as two lovers or two beloveds.
Mm-hmm.
There's always a lover and a beloved, you know. And I was thinking about that, and I thought, well, if that's true, they keep changing roles, though. One isn't continually just the lover, you know. But the ancient Greeks said, no, there's always one in pursuit, and there's always one who's, you know, enticing. And I wanted to understand more about that, you know.
Right.
And I wanted to understand, even in understanding our love for God, because sometimes I think our experience of God can be an erotic encounter. You know?
Oh, absolutely. That's what you should say there, because the poet Andres Montoya, when he was first writing his poems, it was confusing whether or not he was writing about his sexual attraction to a woman or he was talking about God. You know,
yeah.
And I think we do that a lot when we first beginning to write, that passion that we have, you know, perhaps it's a sexual passion at one point, but eventually we see that what's behind that sexual passion is not just the physical. It's love.
Right.
And whatever love means, you know.
Yeah.
You've been writing poetry for a while now, and your first poems, blew everybody away. Your books now are blowing everyone away. But I'm wondering what the relationship or how the image has changed over the years, that are you more willing to have imageless images, or I keep thinking of this idea of the gateless gate, that you approach an image that really isn't an image, but there's an image there. Are you more willing to go imageless now than you were perhaps when you were younger?
You know, Daniel, I love the image. I feel as if we need the image, mm-hmm. you know, and it's just that there are images that I only see vaguely, darkly, you
right.
know, like in a glass, you know, in a mirror or something, or through a window. And I'm trying to understand that image, because at this point in my life, Daniel, I'll be honest with you, I'm guided by these vague images, you
right.
know, because, man, I'd be a lost soul if I didn't have images. You
right,
know,
right.
I need images.
Well, maybe a better way of asking it is, now, are you more willing to try to pursue an image that you can't quite understand? That, like, for example, when you wake up from a dream and it's a very vivid dream, but then that vividness begins to lose that vividness and it just becomes like this light. But and you're trying to get it back. You're trying to get it back. And I'm wondering if now you're able to approach images that maybe you couldn't have approached earlier.
Yes. Yes, I think that's absolutely true. I think I'm able to maintain a kind of peripheral vision where I can see the image out of the side of my eye and I don't need to panic and turn and to look at it directly and then mm-hmm. it goes away, you know. I think I've been practicing this a while. I think I am a little more willing, and I think I need that.
Yeah, and I think there was a reference you made in an interview of that language, using the language of poetry, you know, because it's so specific, it's a lot like coding. And the more you learn to code, the more you're able to express things that were inexpressible before. And so I guess there's two levels of your coding. One, you're much more experienced, but also your reader is more willing to submit themselves to an image that may not be as stark, for example, as a paper bag blowing in the wind. They're willing
right.
to go with you now. And that seems to be like an incredible amount of freedom for a poet. And it must make you feel like you could take on a lot more.
You know, it does. It does, Daniel. It makes feel exactly that. But at the same time, I worry that, you know, maybe I'm just at the beginning of this thing. And I want to keep the rigor and the need for, because I don't want to write vague images. You
right,
know? I want to write as clear images as possible, but if it's vague, it's only because, you know, I it's too far. I'm not developed enough to understand what it is I'm looking at, you know. And I think you said something like this at the beginning of the interview. I feel as if I've been moving toward this all my life, you know, toward patient enough and nimble enough imagination that I can address these things, you know,
right.
because they've obsessed me all my life, you know.
You have this beautiful line in Hidden Hearing. It says, God slips his likeness of me under his pillow. And I love that line. But to me, that's an image. But it's kind of a very difficult image to get to. Not anyone can get away with that.
Yeah. I wonder, too, Dan. Sometimes I look at it. You know, I'm not done writing this book, Dan. This whole publishing thing is so frustrating thing to me. I'll be honest with you. You know, not publishing is frustrating, and publishing is frustrating, you know?
Right.
I look at this book, The Undressing, I think, I could have used another 2 years. And then I think, yeah, but I could have been tooling away at this book for the rest of my life. It doesn't make, that's not the way to do it. Like that line you just quoted, you know, I've been thinking about that line for so long, and I thought, is that what I mean? You know, what do I mean? Because I keep listening to that line. I think, his likeness of me. You mean like a likeness that God makes of me, or our likeness, the ways we are like each other?
Right.
Is that what God slips under God's pillow? What am I actually, but I can't get closer, Daniel. I can't, that's the image.
And also, you know, that God slips his likeness under my pillow is also, you know, the images that are going to come out in the dream.
Yeah, I didn't even go down that road, but you're right. I mean, now that you're saying that is lurking there. And I think it was probably lurking in my imagination. You know, you're right. Yeah, that will unspool in God's dream, yes.
And
my dream of God and God's dream of me, yeah.
And I think that's kind of what I was trying to get at with the imageless image. I mean, your images are incredibly strong here, and there are moments that are so poignant, like when the boy, I think it's a poem about your father in a prison, and your mother slips him a bar of soap, and then you kind of rat him out to the guard. So, I mean, it's not an opaque book. It's not difficult to enter into the poems, yet at the same time, you're able to enter into some sort of moment that is beyond the image at the same time.
Oh, thank you. I hope so. Images are fascinating. You know, they're full of noise. They're full of voices. They're full of ideas. I think good images are exactly what you're saying. They point away from themselves and in all kinds of, they irradiate the mind, you know, so that all kinds of ideas buzz around a really good image, I think, you know.
I'm talking to Lee Young Lee, the author of The Undressing, but I have one more question I want to ask you. And again, I had like 30 questions that I'm just not going to be able to get to. But in the very last poem of the book, it's called Changing Places in the Fire, which I think is a wonderful poem to end with, considering the shape of the book and how you began with The Undressing. There's this conversation and a woman's voice, and she's saying to the poet, she's saying, "You tame high finisher of paltry blots. You publish doubt and call it knowledge. You destroy the wisdom of ages to gratify your envy." And I'm quite cutting a little bit, but it says, "You pretend to poetry and destroy imagination." And I'm wondering if the poet Lee Young Lee ever feels this way about his own poetry.
Oh my God, Daniel, it's 24 hours a day. You know, that voice just has accompanied me for years. And I just thought at this point, I never even had the language to give words to that voice, you know, and I thought I need to give voice to this thing in me and to exercise it in a way, you know, and when I could find the words to accompany the voice, I those are the words that just harangue me all day, you know. That's my inner, I don't know what you want to call it, superego or whatever, you know, that's it's rough and bloody.
Wow. Well, that's good to know, because I think every writer feels that way. And to know that you feel that way, I think it's probably going to make a lot of writers feel good right now.
Well, I'm glad.
There's this line that says, "True lovers know," she says, "hunger vacant of love is a confusion." And I'm thinking that's probably true with poetry too. Poetry vacant of love, and I suppose you can replace that with God. You can replace that with you know, a lot of words, is confusion. And I'm wondering if you ever feel that way, or if you understand why you're writing and what it is you're looking for.
Well, I think in both of the long poems in this book, The Undressing, the poem The Undressing, the poem Changing Places in Fire, I think in writing those two poems, I came to understand that our appetites and our desires, unmediated by love, they just make the world more dangerous. I think desire and appetite and hunger, unmediated by love and vision, creates a dangerous home. I think it creates a dangerous community. I think it creates a dangerous country. You know, and I think without a vision, the people perish. You know, I'm quoting Proverbs from the Bible, but this vision is love. And, you know, love has such a bad name, Daniel. We think it's a kind of blindness or infatuation, momentary, and it can, those are some expressions of it. I think that the ultimate expression of love is a kind of wisdom and an investment and interest in the outcome of others and outcome of the world, and outcome of ourselves too, of the world, and I think love is the most profound form of interest we can cultivate, you know. And, you know, this word interest is interesting to me, Daniel. You know, it means between beings, you know, inter esse, you know. And so I think love is wise and profound and far-seeing, and without that mediating all our desires and our appetites, I think we're just lost. We're just all these competing appetites. You know, we live in a culture of competing appetites. And
right.
I think that that's dangerous. And yeah, and we live in a world of competing appetites, competing egos, competing subjective desires. It's like, that's like a powder keg, it seems to me. You
right,
know?
Yeah. Desire is the gift, not the object of your desire. It's that desire that is the gift, I would think.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah, the energy of desire,
yes.
Right, is the gift.
Right, not what you think it is on the material level, because when you start thinking desire is obtaining something material or something specific, then you're, you know, that's that desire that infuses us all, that makes us want to go search for the lover and the beloved, and, you know, to wander through the city searching for that love. Your poetry is so passionate, and you've never lost that passion, and I just want to say this book is amazing, and everybody should pick it up.
Thank you.
As a kind of a way to end our conversation, Lee Young Lee, thank you so much. I know you're a very busy person. Thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire. Can we have you maybe read one poem from the book?
Sure. Yeah. Which poem do you?
Well, I really like the one that I quoted earlier from Hidden Hearing. It's called on.
Oh, okay. Let me find. Okay, Hidden Hearing. God slips his likeness of me under his pillow. Morning grows cloudy, the house darkens, and I know what the rain at the sill is saying. Be finished with resemblances. Your lamp hides the light. A voice, being a voice and not the wind, can't carry anything away. And yet, it makes any land a place, a country of the air, and laughter its seventh day. Last night I dreamed of voices in a grove, ladders reaching from the ground into the branches. I was mending my children's coats, worrying if the light would last long enough for me to thread the needle. It's spacious beneath God's pillow, where I nod with the trees in the wind, listen to the rain, and count the seconds between the lightning and the thunder. Deaf to former things, unencumbered of things to come, leaving God to recoup a human fate. God snores, his slumber immense, and musty with the season's litter. God rolls over in his sleep and churns the seabed to dislodge many buried keys. Outside, a bird is telling time's green name. It stops when I stop to listen and starts again as soon as I give up, holding my breath to hear it. As though wholehearted listening intrudes, where hearing ajar makes room for singing so tender my attention snuffs it, or else so brimming my ear's least turning spills it. Sooner or later, God will again bear out that semblance he makes of me each day. He'll need fold, punch, pull, mark, smudge, erase, and tear away. Sometimes it feels like love and makes me tremble. Sometimes it hurts like death and makes me shake.
That was Lee Young Lee reading from his new book, The Undressing, a poem called Hidden Hearing. Lee Young Lee, thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much, Daniel.
I'd like to thank my guest, Lee Young Lee, for joining me on Words on a Wire. The name of the book is The Undressing. And I'd like to thank our producer, Lauren Terrazas, and thank you for joining me once again. Have a great week.